Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. This podcast is also available in high-definition video at youtube.com/Mormon Stories.
So we've talked about how wonderful your relationship was with Heather, how she was a gift, how it was magical. And I remember you using a phrase where whenever you would have your emotional outbursts, she would say, "I'll be here when you get back," or "I'll be here when you're done."
I'll be here. Yeah.
So let's talk about when that became threatened.
So we were married in 2001, and I started grad school. So this is, I think, just part of segmenting into this story. Grad school created a lot of cognitive dissonance for me because it was truly, fully the first time that I was spending a lot of quality time with non-LDS people. And they were awesome.
Awesome
sauce. Just such quality, incredible, amazing people who I just fell in love with. And some of them were gay, and most of them were women, and this created a lot of dissonance with church ideas. And I was already trying to figure out, right, how do I make sense of, I got to get married, but I really am only attracted to other men except for Heather. Trying to make sense of that, I'm thinking a lot. And so that started me heavily into a spiritual journey of trying to explore that. And my way of exploring that was I kind of clung to this belief that if all truth is circumscribed into one whole, I just didn't have enough truth. I just need to know more. I don't know why this piece is true, but that's just because I just don't know all the stuff around it. So I just need more information. So I started really gathering as much information as I could.
That's very dangerous, by the way.
As you will come to see. yeah. And grad school, I think it's pretty common for people to feel like their mind starts getting blown open by grad school, because you get a lot of great education about the way things are. And Heather loved watching this for me and me sharing all this information with her. And she's like, yeah, because Heather really grew up with non-member friends. She didn't have hardly any member friends. Her father was a bishop for 10 years and later in the state presidency. Her dad was a convert as an adult when he married her mom, who reactivated herself as the only person active in her family when she was a teenager. I think her older brother might have been active, but he was in the Air Force. They kind of moved around. They didn't have a lot of tradition. Utah tradition. There just wasn't this cultural stuff that a lot of us seem to have a hard time with. Like, there's no bobble. I have the bobble. She had no bobble at all. She was really surrounded by the real world growing up and didn't get a lot of stuff. And when she was growing up and Saturday's Warrior came out and people were into it, she was like, that's dumb.
That's dumb.
Yeah. And she didn't have to listen to it on Sunday, so she never developed a taste for it. So like church music that I just loved, she was like, okay. Some of it's really nice. Not all of it. and as I began exploring and educating and trying to find things out, come 2005, I had started my private practice. So I finished grad school, started my private practice in doing couple and family counseling. And one day a week, I would drive from Denver down to Colorado Springs, which was an hour, to practice down there because I would get referrals from LDS Social Services there. And in so doing, I discovered the relatively new idea of podcasts at the time, and first started with This American Life, but that's 1 hour long. It would get me there, and I wanted something to listen to on the way back. Went searching for Mormon, and I found you, and went, Oh. And after I listened the first time, I thought, jackpot. I mean, this is good stuff. I was so excited by it. So I really, there's a lot of my personal journey that paralleled what I think I watched you going through in terms of the moving in and out of your experience of testimony. Obviously, I'm not you, but I could really feel myself as the podcasts went from informational kind of into we should all stay into the whole why they stay thing. And well, maybe everybody doesn't have to stay. I mean, I was really kind of following it that way. And I would come home to Heather in all of our relationship and I would tell her these, okay, you cannot believe this. Joseph Smith had this many wives and some of them were already married and just stuff like this. Lots of information because these podcasts were brilliant. And I'd share this with Heather and she was like, that's dumb. not as she's not dismissing me in any way. I'd just be like, you know, this about the church. And she's like, I'm sorry, that's crazy. I don't believe that.
And right. So she wouldn't take any doctrine or teaching that was crazy.
Yeah.
Any historical tidbit that didn't make sense to her. She would just say, that's not my Mormonism.
And which is exactly what she would say it in this way. Eldon, you and I grew up in different churches. Yeah. Completely different churches.
Yeah.
We're LDS, but we grew up in different churches, which was a great part of why she was who she was
right. And
could do what she did as a person. So I think that the journey that I was on, it fascinated her, and she was always with me. Like wherever I was at and what I was believing or struggling with, I would share with her and she would be like, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm with you. I really am with you. But usually it was... I was kind of stepping back from my absolute total believing ism. And when I would step back, I would always find that she was like, already here, you know, and we just were together about how we felt about things. So yeah, there were times that I would talk to her and she'd go, okay, I didn't know that, but yeah, it's disturbing. Okay. We don't believe that. In this whole interim, we decided it's time to start a family a couple years after we were married. So bought a house. We had our first daughter who was turning 8 in October here in 2012. And 2 years later had our second daughter and 2 years later got pregnant with our son. So we're kind of, and during this transition, this faith transition, I was in, I call it a faith transition. As I was doing all of this Mormon studies and studying stuff, I spent 5 years of that time as a gospel doctrine teacher in our ward. So I was using a lot of this information to go in and be like, let's not talk about the same old things. Let's talk about new information and new ways to look at the scriptures. And I can't say everyone, but lots and lots of people would come to me and say, "Ooh, this is so great. I really love this. And these are helpful lessons because they're different from the thing we've heard our whole life. It's more information." And I'm thinking, this is all just goodness. Everybody needs more information. Let's get it out there. Yay. Inoculation. Hooray. At the same time, getting a lot more liberal about, not so sure that there really is anything wrong with being gay. Pretty happy about my life. Really not going to come out. Kind of still internally homophobic. But I'm kind of thinking all these people out here who are gay, that's really just fine. It might be just fine. That's in opposition to the church. So I'm feeling myself kind of pull these things apart into different directions and not being so, you know, absolute about things. And so it's really where I was at, in a place of going, I don't know. I love this. I still really believe, but I don't really know a lot of stuff anymore. I know the church is true. Let's stick with that. Joseph Smith's prophet church is true, but Mormon's true. But I don't know that we are really up on all of our revelation because the Lord might need to give us some more information about a whole lot of stuff these days. And it might surprise some people. This is kind of my liberal thinking. And so I was in a place of, I'm good. And certainly I was behaving. I wasn't doing bad at the time. Like, you know, sinning. I wasn't saying there was nothing wrong. I was very faithful there. It's all really good. We're very close and connected. And then we had our son, Kai. Kai, in August of 2008. And 8 weeks later, Heather was diagnosed with stage 3 triple negative breast cancer.
What is that, for those who don't know?
Well, essentially, there's different kinds of breast cancer, and they classify them in a way to help identify what's going to be most helpful to treat it. There are some particular types of breast cancer that are really responsive to particular specific treatments and types of chemotherapy and chemotherapy with additional treatments that really, really work. There's actually some breast cancers that if you get it, you really hope you have this kind, because we can treat it. And there's a great likelihood that it will be treated and it will not be fatal for you. The chances are really great for you. Triple negative breast cancer cannot be treated by any of the known treatments to this day still. They just can do some traditional chemotherapy. But there's no specialized drugs for it, which makes it... The doctor tried to say, this is a good thing because it's the hottest ticket out there. Every drug company on the planet wants to have the specialized drug that works with triple negative, because it's the worst right now.
That's a nice way of saying it.
In addition to that, so, you know, we have this brand new baby.
What year is this?
2008. Yeah, in October of 2008.
Okay.
October 8th. So she was given this diagnosis. And
this is the same year Proposition 8 came out, right? It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. 2007, 2008. But it does.
I kind of lost all sense of the world.
And everything
when this happened. So I was in a place of, I believe the church is true, but I don't. There's a lot of stuff that I don't understand.
Well, that's actually pretty significant now that I think about it. I felt like I was detracting from the interview. But if you, as a gay man, didn't really pay attention to Proposition 8.
Right.
Well, obviously, it's going to be devastating.
I did. I knew it was going on and it mattered. But I had too much going on in my life to be involved in that. And like so many people, I'm not proud of this, maybe a little ashamed, but you know, that's in another state, and I have a lot to do, and I have 3 little kids, and I am married, and things are okay, and yes, I feel strongly about that, but am I going to go door to door? No, I have other things to do. I'm sorry, I'm not proud of that position, but truly, when Heather was diagnosed, like, the world kind of became very focused, and when she received the diagnosis, we really were in a place of, okay, I guess, well, you probably should get this checked out. She had mastitis, which is, it's essentially a lump in the breast while you are breastfeeding, because you get an inflamed area and it becomes red and really hurtful. And she'd had it for weeks.
Very common.
Yeah. But she'd also had them before, but it would not go away. And we called the breast center and they wouldn't do anything about it. And that, it still makes me mad that they wouldn't do anything about it, and they didn't ask her about her family history. And I'm mad that we didn't say anything about her family history. We're 2 grad school educated people. I don't know how we didn't put together that she has a grandmother, 2 great aunts, and 2 aunts, all who had breast cancer early. So we should have put that together. We should have said any sign of mastitis ever should have made people go, whoa, check it out. We didn't. They didn't check it out until her armpit was hurting and it had already moved into her lymph nodes. And we went in to check it out from we should just see, kind of, because it's not going away. Obviously, it's nothing. It's nothing, you know. Well, I remember that the doctor called and I was actually headed to work. And we had been waiting on the doctor call and I had to get to work. And so we kind of just did this whole, I'm sad that I left, but we did this whole reassurance, it's totally going to be fine. And she might not even call till tomorrow. And I got about 5 minutes away and she called me and, you know, I picked up the phone and she was just sobbing. So I knew what had happened. And I came home and can really, there's flashbulb moments in memory, and I can remember walking in and seeing her sitting on one of these exercise balls, holding our little baby and just bouncing on the ball, sobbing and sobbing. And I think it's pretty natural to kick in. It's sort of, I call it emotional shock. It's going to be okay. We can handle this. Oh, it's going to suck. All right, it's going to be terrible, but we can handle this. And we're going to handle this because, of course, you're going to be okay. Of course, you're going to be okay. Which is exactly what happened with her family. Her, you know, her parents and her older brother rushed up from Colorado Springs to be here and to reassure, and everything will be okay. And that first evening is the first time her dad gave her a priesthood blessing. And I decided that first night that I would not be part of it. I would, and I never once gave her a priesthood blessing, which is significant because I really believe in priesthood blessings. I really do. And because I'm a great giver of priesthood blessings all the time. I love studying the Spirit and studying Revelation and really getting like the good stuff in a blessing, not just you'll be filled if you're healed if your faith, you know, allows it, but rather let's give some good stuff. But I decided that moment there's something in me that said I can't be part of any priesthood blessings because I can't be neutral about this. My priesthood revelation, it's possible that it can't be trusted because I'm so close to it. So if I were to say, sure, you'll be healed, then, well, of course, that's what I wanted to say, even though I would try very hard to be really honest about what I was feeling. So I didn't participate. Well, I didn't give it. And I never, again, never after, I never gave her a priesthood blessing. And it said, you'll overcome it. You will be healed. It will be a hard trial. You'll get over the cancer.
By her own father.
Yeah.
By her own father.
Yeah. Which, it's true, and he knows that it's true, but we don't talk about it because he is sorry. It really destroys him to think about that he ever said that, but of course he did. Of course he did. Said that he, you know, she would be killed. And so we started this journey of some really serious chemotherapy for her, and she immediately had to stop breastfeeding, which was very hard for her.
She's kind of a natural mom.
Yeah. Oh, she's such a good mom. I mean, she loved it, and she was good at it. And we had a glorious, just a perfect for us situation because I saw clients for the first 2 days of the week, and then she worked at Children's Hospital as a physical therapist for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So we split the work week and split getting to be at-home parents so that we could kind of have the best of both worlds. And that was really wonderful. And but she, oh, as a mother, she was incredible, just incredible. So, yeah, stopping the breastfeeding was really hard. She's a very scheduled person, and so not having baby, like, right on schedule and having things be as they were supposed to be was really hard, obviously, and we started this nasty, awful chemo that had lots of side effects and was really hard on her. And the plan was that we would do this chemo till somewhere into the second year, and then we would look at a mastectomy because the lump was in her right breast. They said it's stage 3, and so we have to remove the breast. It can't just be a lumpectomy. But what they try to do is use chemotherapy to start killing the cancer so that the lump itself shrinks, and then what you can do is take all the tissue around the lump and you are sure, much more sure then, to get out any cells that might have any remaining cancer in them. So that's what they were trying to do. But it was about 2 months into the chemo treatment, which she started right away. They diagnosed her and started her the same week because it was so fast. But her on the chemotherapy, her tumor grew. So they said, well, we have to take it out now. And so she was scheduled for New Year's Eve to have mastectomy. So all of my family and lots of her family came over for Christmas, and we're trying to do the best we can to create this like normalized life for our kids and for how things are. But with all this craziness around us and of cancer and treatment and how it's just ripping her apart, her whole body. But she also was such a fighter and such a trooper. Side note, people often say, and I honor what they need to say to get themselves through, but people will say, you know, I fought this cancer and I won. I decided to fight so I beat it. I realized, I looked at my children and I realized I can't let it take me, so it didn't. And it makes me angry. Oh, because you don't get to decide. Just because you love the people that you're with, that you get to stay with them. You have to decide to fight it, but only if your cancer is actually beatable will you beat it. So she had mastectomy.
Single?
Yeah. We figured it would be double later, but right now they were just trying to get it done and get back on the chemo as fast as possible. So we needed the least amount of healing time. Just because the tumor that was growing while the chemotherapy was happening is just pretty damn dangerous. And through all of this, she was getting, you know, occasional blessings from people, from our member. There was a member of the bishopric assigned to us when this happened, and he would come check on us, and he was a really great guy. And sometimes the elders' quorum president would come over. But it's also significant to note that the member of the bishopric assigned to us moved after 3 months, and we never again saw the bishopric. And there was some beautiful organization of the ward that happened to help things, but it was a little bit hit or miss. It was really truly about individuals. There were some people in our ward that clicked into what was happening and decided that they were going to help, and they did, and it was beautiful for them individually, but mostly her people at Children's Hospital where she worked kicked it in, and they were there for our family, and they were just constantly, this whole group of women that were her co-workers and some of her other friends from our old singles ward really kicked it in a serious way in being there for this experience. And so there was a lot of incredible charity, but it was, you know, in great part from people individually who decided, and from mostly non-members. And that was really, really beautiful to see. But we were still feeling like this is going to be okay. We're all right. We're still going to beat this. It's kind of serious. It's a little crazy. But still feeling pretty reassured that this is going to be all right, and we're checking in with each other, and, you know, we're going to church and doing our thing, unless she's too sick, which was happening a lot. Then I'd stay home with her.
I think I remember you saying that you kind of pulled away from Mormon Stories during this time. Like,
yeah.
Talk about why. Not Mormon Stories, but what did that represent to you?
Well,
in a larger sense in your life?
You know, she was going to be okay, but this crisis made me go, I don't have my spirituality figured out, even though I believe the church is true. There are a lot of things that I don't know about and I'm wondering and questioning about. And how about we just don't poke the bear? You know, like right now we're asking for some serious help and I have felt like it's okay to question, but just in case it's not, let's not poke that bear. Like, let's not question too much in case I have it wrong and faith really does mean not ever questioning. We'll get back to it, is what I'm thinking. It'll be okay. And this will help me figure things out even more when this whole experience is done. This will be really significant. And it has always been significant to me that my patriarchal blessing told me I would see and testify of miracles, literally. And so I thought, okay, well, all right.
Here we go.
Did it have to be this big? So as we figured out that her tumor was growing while she was on chemo, and that kind of got scary. And I think Heather would sometimes get more scared than me because she worked at a hospital with children who had cancer. And so she had a better idea that, you know, this doesn't turn out well a lot of times. So we approached a gentleman in our ward who we were somewhat close to. He was an older gentleman who we really loved, and he loved our family, and he and I had been switching weeks on teaching gospel doctrine, and he had talked many times, both in class and sometimes talked to us about that he literally had the gift of healing and that there were some people that he had healed.
It's interesting that Heather's father's blessing at that point wasn't enough for you guys.
Of course not.
Talk about that.
I think it's about being scared. I mean, his blessing was real and we believed it until we got more scared. And so it wasn't about not believing what we had already been told. It really wasn't. I think it's more about kind of like the experience of when you get told the church is true by the Spirit and you have a testimony, that doesn't always mean that you never need to hear it again. Just because someone says they love you doesn't mean, you know, this whole, if it changes, I'll tell you. That doesn't work. Turns out that's not so good for relationships.
But it also
reminded.
I don't know if this is going to connect with you, but it reminds me of your teenagers and your college years, mm-hmm. where you were righteous, but at some point, 30 minutes wasn't enough of scripture reading. You needed mm-hmm. 40.
Yeah.
And one day of fasting wasn't enough, and so you needed 2.
Right. Well, nothing was if things were going to change in one day of fasting, well, then great, we're done. But when nothing changes, then maybe you need to add 2. But it wasn't just nothing was changing. It was getting worse. The cancer was getting worse. And so, okay, that was good, and we do believe, but, well, it really couldn't hurt to have some more, and this guy has this particular spiritual gift, like, by all means. And this was actually really Heather's request. She said, I've been really thinking and pondering and praying, and I really feel like I need to get a special blessing from our friend. And so I called him, and we arranged it. We were kind of, like I say, we were nervous and scared. This was after the mastectomy, and they put her right back on chemo. So this is into January.
2009.
Yes. And this is, I'm kind of skipping a lot of little tiny spiritual experiences that we're having all along the way about that we're really scared, but things will be okay. They'll be okay. And not, they will be okay, the Lord will work it out even though it's a terrible trial. It's really, they will be okay, she will overcome cancer and live. Anyway, we arranged this blessing, and it was a really big deal to us because she felt like she should get it, and it was from somebody important who claimed to have this gift, and we felt really good about it, and we really prayed a whole lot about it, and arranged this Monday morning. We went down to the church and met together and had this blessing, and I was, you know, we were kind of, I guess, hyped up enough about it that I, you know, pulled out my phone and I recorded it and later even transcribed it so that she could read, because we wanted to be faithful about what we had been told. We really didn't want to do a blessing every week. I mean, it felt like things are getting low. Let's get a blessing. Why not? It will help. But we weren't, you know, it wasn't like we had to do this blessing all the time because we don't believe. And the blessing was gorgeous and it was beautiful and it was so uplifting and it was absolutely one page transcribed long of great clarity. You will beat this cancer. You will live. You will live because you have work to do with the young women of the church. You have work to do with your children. You will live to see your son grow on a mission. You have specific goals and things that have to be accomplished with other women in the Relief Society. Going on and on about all these details and things that have to happen and that will happen because she's going to live. She's going to beat this cancer. And lots of times we came back to that blessing and reviewed it because it was real and we felt the Spirit. We felt the Spirit. There were wonderful feelings. It was so true. It was so right. And I was so grateful, obviously. So grateful. And so then as the months go on, we're still, there's a real struggle. It's hard to like summarize this all in too much, but we're up and down and back and forth because this is really hard and it's super hard on her. And also we have a brand new baby and a 3 and 5 year old, our 5 year old who's in kindergarten. I mean, we're just trying to live this whole life. And Heather had to keep working just enough where we had no insurance because I didn't carry the insurance. Mm-hmm. So, which was fine because getting out of bed actually was very revitalizing for her, but not fine because she never felt well. And she told me as we were kind of finishing up the whole chemotherapy experience and getting into the radiation. We did radiation for 6 weeks at the end of it. So finally we can call it good and done. And this was into the end of May and into June of 2009. She finally shared with me that she'd had an experience in January waking up after her mastectomy that was fairly rare for her. But she really, really felt like God came and talked to her. That through the Spirit, she was asked, do you want to live? You have a choice. And if you choose yes, it will be very hard. And she said yes. I remember one time we feeling that she shared it with me because I was feeling really scared. Because there are just times when I was really realizing, you know, you can be faithful and doubting at the same time. You can be two things at the same time. And when I was scared with doubt, this one time she shared that with me. It was kind of weird that she hadn't shared it with me before and I brought that up and she said, I thought I would scare you. I thought the fact that the Lord told me that it was my choice and if I chose, I'd die. I thought would really scare you. So she chose not to tell me that until then, but she answered the question in her very, very strong experience. Okay, I'll do it. Yes, I realize it will be hard, but I will do it. I want to live. I want to be with my family. So it's okay. This is going to work. It's going to be all right. It was emotionally taxing on a relationship. It was really up and down for us as individuals, but we made it into the beginning of June. She finished radiation. They call it markers in your blood to see if there's any particular markers in your blood that indicate cancerous growth. And they had lessened down to the point of that we'd beat it. We're okay. We're good. Through the chemo, through the radiation, and then we began, like, we picked up life's plans real quick. Like, okay, we've got this. We're good. We like L school, but we kind of like to be in a better school district than we're at. So we called a realtor. We started working on it's time to sell the house and we should move forward. And we called a family meeting with her family about, okay, it's hard. We still have a lot of healing to do, but we're going forward. We're going to be happy. This is going to be okay. We're so grateful, and this has been our miracle, and we're going to be all right. But her back is really, really hurting, which is maybe that's just from the radiation. But it kept hurting, and it kept hurting, and we finally went in and said, what's going on? And they said, well, it's probably just radiation again. And so by the first week of July, on Emma's birthday, our second daughter, by that evening, we had to go to the ER because she couldn't stand anymore. And, of course, they just did all these tests and come to find out that her cancer had just moved into her liver with a vengeance. And there was a lesion up in her lung, but that didn't look as serious, but it was all about the liver. And breast cancer in the liver, so it had gotten into the blood, it was breast cancer in the liver.
Mm.
Which is different from just liver cancer, because the way that breast cancer shows up is with hundreds of tiny lesions, little tumors. So you can't transplant. You can't do anything except try to chemo it out. So we started up the chemo again. However, she, when we were at the hospital, her oncologist came in, and she was out for tests, and the oncologist had kind of looked at everything and came in, and she wasn't there, just me. And I asked her, no, please, you need to tell me what you know and what's going on, because then I will tell her, or you can tell her and I will have prepped her, but that will be better. So her answer to me was, well, the longest I've ever seen anybody survive this is about 4 years. But you need to prep. She's going to die. Which is a moment that's really indescribable. So the doctor, she left the room, and I, you know, I fell to my knees and felt like, maybe I haven't been good enough. Maybe you're mad at me. But I really need you to hear me. She has to be okay. She has to be okay. For our children, for me. And yes, I was thinking about, you know, like, this will never work again. If you take her, I will never have anybody again. And it's not okay for people to be alone. I didn't say that earlier, but let me be clear. The idea that you should be celibate your whole life is absolutely horrific. That you should be alone your whole life. No. So I'm on my knees, and I'd had this happen before. Sometimes I get emotional. Sometimes I get the goosebumps. Sometimes I get a burning in the bosom. And sometimes I really feel like I've heard a voice. Really just this audible thing that nobody else is hearing but I am. As I'm praying there, I got that. And the voice of the Lord said to me, I will take care of this. And I knew, with the testimony knowledge, I knew he would heal her. It wasn't a matter of interpretation and me getting that wrong. I know what he meant. He would heal her. He promised me. How I banked on it. But also dangerous to me later is that with that feeling came the sense that I, like all of this, I better earn that. And I better not blow it. Because if I blow it, if I do something wrong, maybe he won't do it. So it really was this, I have to be perfect. I cannot doubt. I cannot do anything wrong. I mean, that all really kicked in. And so we started the journey of chemo, and that was second week of July. And from there, they started a chemo that was a little, like, it kind of helped a little, sort of stopped the growth, and shrunk some of the bigger tumors just a tiny bit. But it also was not quite so side effect intrusive. So she had a few months of a little bit better than it had been. And a few months of feeling a little better because her hair started to grow back on this particular type of chemo. And she had long, gorgeous, dark, curly hair that she loved. It was kind of her personal vanity that she loved her hair. And so it was starting to grow back, and that was really uplifting. But the truth is, she just, her health started going, and things were not good. And so
did she ever have that conversation with you where she's contemplating her own death?
I say 1.5 times. When we went, we love to celebrate holidays, we love to celebrate birthdays, we love anniversaries. We were a party with each other people. And on my birthday in October, things were not going well. And I knew it, and she knew it. But we were...
2009.
Yeah, 2009. And we're banking on the miracle will happen. But we just have to wait on the Lord till whenever it is that he's going to do it. And meanwhile, we're going to do our part. Because that's what you do, right? So we're doing our part of chemo or whatever. But on our birthday, I turned around to her. My birthday. In the middle of just enjoying the evening, because, well, she hadn't been well. She couldn't eat the whole night. She couldn't eat it. And I remember turning, just being sort of overcome all of a sudden, turning around to her and saying, "What if you die?" And her, in that moment, saying, "It's not going to happen." You know, I think she saw me hurting and instantly went into reassuring me. And so that's not going to happen. It's going to be okay. Then as she continued to get worse and worse, it was only a couple weeks after that that we finally decided, okay, we're going to have this, like, not doubting but practical talk. And this was, it was about 2.5 weeks before she actually died, that we walked around the house, and it was under, if you should die, then this.
We're not doubting.
No, because there could be a car accident. Everybody should have this talk.
Of course.
With their significant others about, if I should die, then this and this should happen, and I would like this and this and this.
But it's
practical.
But this theme has come up a lot, not just with Heather's illness, but with your struggles with same-sex attraction. It's this idea that if you don't get it quite right, then God is what?
He's not going to come through. I didn't deserve that. I'm not enough. I didn't deserve that.
So you're...
We are not doubting. I mean, look at what's on the line if you doubt. It just was not okay. And things were getting so obviously. This was massive cognitive dissonance. It's such a fight to literally watch her wither away and become incapable and see what is happening to her mind and to her body and be faithful. They had to put her on drugs for her pain that she was on for a little while one day. And she said things to me that were not really that horrific. But between us, she had never, ever been mean to me. And she said mean things to me. And I was like, is this how low we have to go? Like, when does this kick in? We had a talk about what if you should die? Because you should just practically have that. And went through the house, discussed things that, you know, like, I want this to do this or this to go that, and these papers are here. And pretty much I was like, yeah, I already know all that. And she said, and if I should die, I would really like my dad to conduct my funeral. And I would like you to sing that one song, my favorite song, at the funeral, if you can do that. Years before, I had happened to sing in sacrament meeting for a friend of mine in a different ward. I was not his father, he was mine, from the Forgotten Carols. I don't think it's that, like, awesome sauce of a song. But what, for whatever reason, that performance had super, super touched her. She really connected to it. And so she was like, I like that one enough. That sing that at my funeral, if that happens. So those are the two things that I knew about her funeral. Then this is getting into November. And I put up everything at the beginning of November for Christmas, so there could be some sort of like cheer and hope, you're going to make it to Christmas kind of thing. All our Christmas trees and decorations and whatnot. And I think it was a couple days later that...
Didn't she also say something about your future potential relationship?
Yeah. So like a couple days later, she pulled me aside. And I think she was trying to have another, like, if I should die talk. And I feel like it's the greatest parting gift almost that she tried to give me, even though we weren't acknowledging it as parting. But she pulled me aside. We sat on the edge of the couch. And she said, I need you to know that if I die, I'm okay with our children having two dads. And I think I couldn't even talk about it, you know. I thought, you're getting serious about this. We're not talking about that. So we didn't say anything further. And yet it's one of the best gifts maybe she could have given me in parting. And I remember only just a day after that, pulling her out, like on an evening, to the swing in the front of our house. The porch swing I made her for her 30th birthday. She died when she was 34. And sitting on the porch swing and apologizing. I'm so sorry that she was dying and I hadn't been good enough to say. And true to form for her, she just, you know, she just held me. But it was right soon after that she became bedridden. When you have liver failure, which was happening because of the tumors in her liver, your body can't clean your blood. And so her blood got filled with ammonia. And ammonia in your blood makes your brain stop working. And so she couldn't do anything. She became bedridden, and sometimes she would wake up just enough to say a few things, but for about a week and a half, she was completely flat in bed and really couldn't say anything. But the night before that became complete, so this is all like in a matter of like 1 week, all this stuff, we called over the gentleman again, and you know, she had some more priesthood blessings from various people to help along the way, but we called our gift of healing guy over again and said, you know, things aren't good. We, you know, please come give a blessing. And so he did. He says it took, you know, lots of prep for that, and came over, and it was a Sunday night. And I helped carry her downstairs. We had an upstairs bedroom to a chair and sat her in the chair. And he came in to give the blessing, and which it's hard for him to walk. He's an elderly gentleman. And I really felt like things were completely on the line. I can remember literally laying at her feet while he gave her a blessing and saying to the Lord, you know, I'll do what you want. If I've had it wrong all along, and you need to take her, okay, I'll let it go. Whatever you need to do, you can do. If you need to take her, you can take her, but just tell me. Just tell me. And he gave her the blessing that said, only, I promise you, you will be healed. And you will live. And I cannot recall ever being so completely willing to hear whatever the Lord would tell me. And the Spirit absolutely confirmed for me what he said. So I carried her back upstairs, and her sister stayed with her, and I drove over to my brother's house, where a great deal of my family was, and walked in and let them all know. She's going to live. I don't know how, but she's going to live. And I'm so grateful, and I feel so grateful to feel peace about the fact that she's going to live. It's going to be a miracle. I had gotten myself to the place of being willing to hear whatever. And he told us. And it wasn't just the man speaking. The Spirit told me. And then I watched her deteriorate for the next week. Farther and farther. And kept thinking, how low do we have to go? But it's going to be okay. And there's this thing in me that's saying, there's this part of me, I'm happy to say, that is not that stupid. And was terrified. And yet this part of me that was very, I am consciously overriding you, we are going to be okay. We have to be, and plus the Lord told me. So that was Sunday. By Friday night, Thursday was Thanksgiving. By Friday night, it just wasn't. Things weren't okay. It keeps using that phrase, but it keeps getting worse. And Saturday morning, one of her physical therapy friends came over and helped me get behind her and prop her up, so that I could just hold her in bed. And she died that morning. And I can remember thinking, maybe this is part of the plan. Like, she'll die. All the cancer will die, and then her spirit will come back to her body. And she will live again. But the cancer will have died, and so then her body can sort of flush it out, and this is, okay, that makes sense. So I sat there holding my dead mother for like 30 minutes waiting for her to come back. Which obviously she didn't. And the world just ended. Just ended. And I did my best to help take care of her. And there's, again, thank everything for emotional shock, because at some point you have to get stuff done. There are funeral homes to be called and arrangements to be made, and this all has to happen. And I was determined that there would be nothing that happened with or about her, nothing that I was not involved with or part of, because I would be with her in everything. In everything, I would not leave her alone. So we prepped all this stuff that day and put together a funeral program. And here's where it started to become really problematic church-wise. Was my experience. I mean, already there are obvious spiritual problems and implications going at this point. But I didn't have time. Like, I was so besought with grief that I didn't need to think about those for a couple of days. We could put that aside. But I knew of only two things she wanted for her funeral. And so we were going to make those happen. And we've been full tithing, happy active members our whole life. So of course we're going to have a funeral in the church. So we called and started trying to arrange that. And the bishop was out of town for a day and then he came back. But on the phone, he was very adamant about, well, you can't do anything at a funeral that I don't approve and I will be conducting. And I was like, she really wants her dad to conduct, who, by the way, has been a bishop twice. So if that's, you know, matters priesthood-wise, he's a temple worker. He's been a bishop twice. It's really okay. And this bishop was like, no. And so we're like, could you please check the stake precedent? He's like, all right. So he checks with the stake precedent, comes over 24 hours after she's died, like, brisks right in with this whole, hi, how are you doing? I've just been with my family for Thanksgiving. It was marvelous. We had 42 people in the same house. It was all wonderful. And I was sitting on the couch going, what's wrong with you? I was out of my mind at the time. And he sat down. His first words to me were, well, this is a time of great sorrow, but also a time of great joy. Because we know the plan. And I think I've heard this kind of sentiment before and understood it in the church, but never did I so fully get the kind of bullcrap that is. There is no joy. The plan is not joy. She's gone right now. And if I live a normal life, I won't see her for another 50 years. That's not joy. That's later. So we were not off on the right foot. He commences to tell me that it's really important for me to be very careful right now because I need to watch my behavior. I need to be very, it's important that I not have any moral transgressions at this time.
As if you hadn't been very careful.
Right, as if I hadn't been very careful or as if I was going to run out and have sex right now with someone else. It was ridiculous. Like, you're trying to check my moral behavior right now?
But I mean, you've been trying for your whole life.
Oh, yeah.
To be perfect in every way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
so, you know, so I didn't know how to respond to him in those moments. So he continues and goes on to tell me that this, you know, the church handbook instructs that the current local bishop will conduct the funeral. And so it's important that he does that because it's a matter of faith and obedience. If you don't want me as the bishop to conduct the funeral, that's a show of disobedience and faith, and that you are not, like, if you're not wanting what the church handbook says, he was very clear with me, you're not being faithful and obedient. Now, I can give to him that he may not have understood what that meant to me, but for the person who just thought my righteous, like her living might be contingent on my righteousness, he just told me I'm not faithful or obedient just because I want her father to conduct the funeral. And I lost my chief. I lost it. As in, and I've never had this experience before or since. I literally started hyperventilating, bent over on the couch, gasping for breath. And then, after I was sitting there, fully embarrassed and unable to stop this in front of this man for several minutes, he finally reaches over and says, well, listen. Okay, we'll let her father conduct the funeral, okay? We'll let her him do it. To which felt to me like, oh, you annoying, whiny teenager. All right, fine, I'll give you what you want. And I couldn't handle it. I had to leave. I just stood up and left. And I remember telling him something on the way about like, you're trying to tell me it's my fault that she died because I'm not obedient. And just left. And her father came in and handled the rest, to which the bishop told her father, look, the stake president said from the beginning that you can conduct this funeral. I just thought it was a good time for a lesson. And I wasn't well. I just wasn't in any way okay, mentally, physically, spiritually at all. And so I'm now going, my wife is gone. I don't know what to do with my life. And my priesthood holder disapproves of me. And I'm trying to have this funeral where he's like all upset with me. What do my priesthood leaders think about me? What's wrong with me? There's no great sense to why I was thinking what I was thinking, other than the fact that I was absolutely out of my mind. But I think like his behavior, it's important for me to note that I'm not out of the church, or I don't leave the church, or I don't let my spirituality be affected by someone else's behavior. That's not okay with me. My spiritual life cannot be governed by someone else being an ass. But as much, I think it does speak to, I know that for many people, their experiences, maybe they don't believe in the truth claims of the church, but it is their people. It is not my people. That is my experience. I know individual Mormons that I love, 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 and adore, but I don't have a group inside the church that I never walk in the ward and think, these are my people. And to me, this is an example of why someone being offensive doesn't drive me out of the church. But if the only reason I had left was because of the people, well, I don't have that left. And because as things progressed through the years after that, it's now been almost 3 years since she died, November 28th, I have had way too many LDS people give me their opinion about how I'm grieving too much and too long and not faithful enough and don't believe in the Savior enough or the temple ordinances enough, and I need to be more focused on, you know, families are forever, and isn't that wonderful, and isn't it great joy?
Meaning, if you believed more in the temple ceremony and in the plan of salvation, you wouldn't be sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trust more. You know, they would say,
yeah,
trust more in the plan of salvation.
Right.
Yeah. Not working for you.
Not even remotely. Not even remotely. I mean, in the end, the funeral service was okay, but, and I'm grateful, but that I actually had ready a few things I want to read because I think this is inappropriate. I will be wide open about saying that. I can't get on board with this. The church can do what it wants to do with its own facilities, obviously, but I think that for an active church member, there needs to be some more concession, understanding, and love and compassion when someone dies because, oh, well, that's, you know, saying it's our building and we can do with it what we want and there are rules that we will follow the way we want to. It's not okay to say to someone who just lost their loved one, well, if you don't want to follow our rules about funerals, then find a different place. That's not okay. Well, maybe you should have known beforehand. No, I don't accept that either, to be honest. My problems are this. In the church handbook, it says, under funerals conducted in the church, teaching and testifying about the plan of salvation, particularly the Savior's atonement and resurrection, is an essential purpose of the services associated with a church member's death. It is an essential purpose to testify. The bishop conducts it, and furthermore, a funeral conducted by the bishop, whether in a church building or another location, is a church building, is a church meeting and a religious service. And yeah, I'm kind of like jumping into quotes here, not everything in between. When a bishop conducts a funeral, he or one of his counselors oversees the planning of the service, but he ensures that the funeral is simple and dignified with music and brief addresses and sermons centered on the gospel. And finally, funerals provide an important opportunity to teach the gospel and testify of the plan of salvation. They also provide an opportunity to pay tribute to the deceased. However, such tributes should not dominate a funeral service. The funeral of the church is expected that it not be about the person who we are there to remember and honor. That's ridiculous. It is the expectation that if we let you have a funeral in our church, you will talk about the plan of salvation to the people who are there. It is a missionary tool, and that's so inappropriate. It's inappropriate. If that's what a family wants, fine. because lots of family and people do want that about their service. They do. But it was not okay. It's not okay to direct grief about that. I understand that you have to have some parameters about not wanting to let people do whatever it is here, there. Again, I'm not trying to go to the bottom of the rabbit hole, but I just think the things they expected of us were not okay, and it's not okay for other people. The funeral was not about missionary work. It should never have been. It was a moment to really focus on the grief of losing my partner, of losing my children's mother, of her. And I did everything within me to make it so, and I feel happy about that. But there were still, you know, several required talks from the bishop and another one about the plan of salvation that I had lots of people come to me afterward and say, this was such a beautiful service. I think it really honored her well. Except those two, because it just doesn't fit. I'm sorry, this is not a church meeting for missionary work. So on record, I can't stand it. It's not okay. Here's the, I kind of say it this way about my experience after Heather died with the church. I did that. I mean, people even said, well, you say you felt the spirit, but it was really Satan just deceiving you. Because I know people are trying to make sense of what I was saying about the spirit giving me promptings that were obviously not true. But what occurred to me pretty fast is I felt the spirit, not softly and indistinguishably, multiple times, very clear. I have studied it most all of my life to understand it. I have sought it out. It's not foreign to me. I love to feel the Holy Ghost, and I sought to seek it, and I sought to seek it from a deep level, not an emotional level, and I sought to get it from a not just because this is what the answer I want it to be level, and do so very, very honestly. And every single thing that I felt, I made it up. I made it up. And if every instance of the Holy Ghost that I felt, I made it up because it's what I wanted it to be about Heather, then every other confirmation of the truthfulness of the gospel of Jesus Christ is absolutely subject to doubt. That's how I know the church is true. The same thing that told me Heather would live. I made it all up. And it started to be completely over for me. Completely over. I tried to make it continue to work. But it was gravity. It was falling fast. That I can't go to church. It feels horrible to me. I know none of this is true. I know that I know nothing. Know nothing. I can choose what to believe, but everything that has ever been what it's supposed to be is completely lost its absolute credit. And I can sort of hear in my head and heard for a long time people's excuses about why it was my fault. Again, it's always my fault. Always. I didn't get the spirit right. I didn't hear it correctly. I misinterpreted it. It's always my fault if the church isn't true.
If you're not cured of your same-sex attraction.
Right.
If
everything.
If Heather dies.
If Heather died, like, yes. It's always my fault, which is a weird way of making myself important, almost. But so unhealthy, and it's so not, it's not okay. It doesn't make any sense to me to be part of a gospel where anything that goes awry is my fault, but everything that goes good is not credited to me. I mean, I guess that makes sense with how I felt about myself growing up, but it just kind of meant that the church for me started plummeting. And yes, people can try and nuance around in their own minds my story and say, well, this or that, you didn't feel the spirit, or you didn't know what you were talking about, or you just thought the spirit was emotions when really it's something much deeper and richer and more pure. And I'm sorry, I did it all. I absolutely fully, wholly reject that from my position. The spirit was made up. I did it. Which means, while we're pretty amazing as human beings, it's what we can convince ourselves of. But that's what I got. And now I was left in a world where the church wasn't true. Or at least, if it was, I certainly didn't know it, because everything I'd ever thought about it and all the things that held me to it were completely suspect. Then come in all the knowledge that I've been gleaning. Remember how you say it's dangerous? All the knowledge that I have starts coming back to me, and there's no spirit to hold up my testimony. And I go, no, thank you. I don't want this anymore. Even though I did want it because I wanted it to be true. I wanted it to be true. I remember it was actually the beginning of this summer, walking down one of the flights of stairs in my house at that moment and having kind of this moment of prayer where I don't want to be sacrilegious to anybody. This is just my experience. But I remember praying to Jesus, saying, okay, you and I were best friends, weren't we? How did you not tell me this is fake? How did you not tell me? And you know what I got back? Nothing. It's hard to live in a silent world spiritually. But it's where I'm at. And it's really, really hard to be without the one person who loves me no matter what, who was my connect to partner all the time. And I can see, what if by some medical weirdness and something what happens? Because this spontaneous kind of healing happens now and then. What if she got better? If she just happened to get better, we'd have done, it's a miracle. I'll testify the rest of my life. I will throw down on you because I know it is true. And you cannot deny. I would, like, what if she had spontaneously just gotten better? Because that does happen. Wow, we would have been locked in. Huh. Although, as much as I'm grateful for kind of a lesson in reality, more than kind of a full lesson in reality that I feel like this has been, let me be clear. You can take this lesson and shove it. Give me her back and you can have all the lessons you want. I don't want them. I don't need them. There is no sense of this Mormon idea that, like, I'm so grateful for my trials, or I wouldn't trade my trials and my lessons for the world. Yes, yes. But I don't get her back. And I couldn't be in the church. I couldn't be in the place that taught me that I'm worthless. Because without her here, I have to learn that I'm worth something, even without her reminding me that I'm worth something. And so I've been working on that and on what I do believe, but it's been really hard. The LDS world is what I grew up surrounded with, and I like to say it this way. In general, individuals aside, Mormons are really good at comforting those that stand in need of comfort. They're horrible at mourning with those who mourn. They don't mourn well. Our whole culture does not mourn well. Mormons do not mourn well. And so this grief process has been really, really lonely and hard, with the exception of some amazing people that have been on it with me. But
let me ask you just maybe one question or two. So there's an argument that says, you know, I may not believe in Santa Claus, but I sure enjoy Christmas.
That's me.
So yeah, she didn't pull through, but look at how much hope you had through the process and how religion kind of plugged that hole of doubt and nihilism that you might have felt in this desperation. You kept fighting. You had hope. You believed in that next day. How can you say that wasn't good? And would you have had it another way if you had it to do over again?
I think
rewind to 2008, right. And you're both atheists,
right?
Because Mormon stories takes you both out of the church,
right? Okay,
is it a happier, better death?
Okay, well, first of all, would we have fought less for her to live if we were atheists? No, we would have fought just as hard. Would we have had more conversations about what was really going to happen? Yes. I think that it was sort of healing and calming and peaceful to her to believe she was going to live until she didn't, even though in her last days, I know she knew she wasn't going to.
But so it was meaningful to her to hold on to hope that she would still live.
I think so, but could it have been better or just as good? Maybe not better, but just as good to not have that hope? I believe the answer is yes. I do. We could have still held to each other. We could have loved each other just as much, been just as present for each other, and probably had a lot more conversations about reality and what we hoped for each other and what this experience really meant for us if we weren't spending all of our energy trying not to believe what was so obviously in front of our face.
I'm trying to avoid that conversation because it would be a symbol of doubt.
Right. Right. Now, does that, I mean, people can be faithful and still go, you're going to die, so let's have that conversation. But just in our situation, yeah, I do believe we could have been atheistic and still had a as good or if not better experience together. I mean, this is small, but I don't know that maybe this resounds for everybody, but when she died, I was with her, I was holding her. But I was waiting for her to come back instead of with all of my heart and soul just being with her while she went. I wish that I had just been able to be with her instead of waiting for her to come back. So that, okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Do you think that, I remember you telling me that when you would come to her with questions you got from Mormon stories, and she would say, that's not my church.
Yeah.
You know, that all that belief, we're not going to believe that, right?
Yeah.
What if it's just as simple as you got the wrong teaching, that priesthood blessings are really going to heal you, that sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, but God takes who he takes and death happens and there's no escaping it. And there's a lot of Mormons out there that when they get that blessing that you're going to be healed, they do what Heather did when you brought polyandry to her. They're just like, it may work, but it may not. And let's not put too much stock in these.
Right.
What if you were just, like you talked about expectations, what if you were just set up to put too much stock in these a little bit superstitious kind of prayers, and you tied your Mormonism to a kind of a false doctrine or a folk doctrine.
Right. Well, in the conference right after she died is when we had a talk about, you know, priesthood blessings really aren't to be trusted, you know, too damn late, suckos. You could have told me that before. No, I don't even know that everybody really took that talk and said, yeah, that's true. We don't trust them anymore. What if I just believe too much false doctrine? What if it's my fault? Everything's my fault. I'm not the one who chose what doctrine would be given to me.
Well, if it's churches, what if it's that those Sunday school teachers and those seminary teachers' fault for, you know, setting you up?
Right. Well, then just correlate more. That's not going to be the answer. It's that, you know, trying to control what people teach spiritually, I don't think having more control is going to be the issue. I think it's about teaching to pull from the church correct principles. Correct principles and let people govern themselves. And I don't see the church teaching principles. I do not. Well, okay, they teach principles, but that is not the crux of the church. The church teaches absolute obedience, and here's the rules, and here's the laws. And isn't it nice they're based on principles? I think we just should only teach principles. From what I'm hearing in your question is a little bit, if I'd have been a different, maybe a different person, or if I'd have been taught differently, would my experience be different? Would I still go to church? Would I still believe it was true because it wasn't based on a whole bunch of spiritual things that I thought I felt? What if I was one of these more solid people who just read the scriptures and they know that it's true and it just makes good sense and they're not questioning because they don't need to question? And what if I was just not so emotional? Well, in part, that's like saying, what if I wasn't me? But I am. And the other part, I think, is if I didn't believe all this stuff so surely and wasn't so invested the way that I've described, the answer to your question is maybe I'd still be going to church. You bet.
But that doesn't necessarily make it true either, right? That's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. Just because I was still believing doesn't mean that it's
that's true.
Right.
And now I'm kind of flipping to the other side. The doctrine, there's more than one doctrine we're talking about here, because one is priesthood blessings, but the other is prayer.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to you about this a few months ago, and you already alluded to this a little bit, but what did your prayers mean? And what could you trust?
Well,
and why couldn't Heavenly Father communicate to you in a way to where things were clear when it was so, when this was the time where maybe it mattered most for you to get some clarity?
Well, the church answer in my head again says it's my fault. Something was wrong about me that I didn't get the right answer. But prayer, it actually occurred to me during the experience of cancer very strongly, as so many people were like, we're praying for you, we're praying for you. I mean, that's the answer ad nauseum, that you're totally in our prayers, just in a million ways, in our prayers and thoughts. And I think that that is not a bad thing. But what occurred to me, as people said this over and over and over and over and over, is prayer is for the prayer only. Prayer changes the position and feeling or charity or just like the soul of the person who is praying. And it puts them in a better position and space. It doesn't have to, it doesn't always, but that's the power of prayer, I think, that it changes the prayer. Whether God is there or not, they are putting themselves in a quieter, more in tune, kind of a focused position that can be really positive and from which much great action and a lot of love can come. But I don't think that it brings about things that you ask for because you asked for them. I think it can put you in the position of feeling, of getting, you know, finding a way to get what it is that you have really focused on that you need center on your life. But it doesn't just happen just because you prayed and then the Almighty gave it to you. And it started to irritate me too. Prayer started to kind of irritate me as a principle because I heard so many, you know, over and over, oh my gosh, we're praying for you. We're totally praying for you. And first of all, I wanted to respond, I don't need your prayers. Hug me. Send me a message. Like, I don't know. There's, I can list off a million things you could do that could be literally helpful and supportive to me. And praying for me is not one of them. Because that's been done. The prayer has happened. Whatever's going to happen from the prayer has happened. And it starts to feel like you're telling me that you're going to pray for me as your way out of doing anything else. Now, that's dismissing a lot of people's charity and love and kindness. And I don't want to do that. But I still think, I want to push against that and still think that there's an element of what people do when they say prayers and thoughts for you that's about, that's my ticket, like that's my check mark. I've said prayers and thoughts for you, and so that's all I'm doing. Instead of really engaging with something that I might really need, because does God, do we really believe God needs to hear 1,000 times instead of one? If you do, then I guess we're in opposition about what we believe, but I have a hard time with the Heavenly Father or Mother or God of any kind that says...
It's like, nope,
not yet, more. Like, you got to keep putting the coins in the slot? No. And my other issue with that is to feel like, honestly, I'm saying prayers for you. Are you? How many times do we just say, I'm praying for you on Facebook, my friend has cancer. Oh, prayers for you. How often does that actually equal somebody literally petitioning their God? So I feel like prayer has become this out for people and it's so often not actually happening. And in the end, it's a good thing, but it's for the person praying.
So three final questions and you can make them as short as you want. Would you take prayer, now that you've had a souring on prayer, would you take that away from everybody else if you could, in the sense that you could enlighten them as to your perspective now? Do you kind of wish that there could be a world without prayer?
No. No. I wish there could be a world with more directed, purposeful prayer. I wish there could be a world with prayer where we understand what it's for, where we own prayer is to put myself in my place, not to get something for you. I am not magic with my words, getting something for you.
But for yourself.
Yeah. But if we really own the truth of it, I have prayed. I still occasionally pray. From my perspective, I really feel like I don't know if someone's listening. I don't. But I recognize something is happening right now that I am personally quite powerless about. So if there's something going on out there and this can help, please. And I'm really being honest.
And if not?
If not, I'm going to do my best. Or, you know, going into kind of meditative prayers, if it's not just talking to God, but just putting yourself in a different place. What could be better than that? People putting themselves in a better place, if that's what you're calling it for. I would not take it out of the world.
So would you advise parents to teach their children and churches to teach their members of a more pragmatic approach to prayer?
Yeah.
A less superstitious approach?
Yes.
Does that take away the power of prayer?
Well, seeing as, you know, considering what I actually think the power of prayer is, no.
It instead prevents people from being set up for disappointment.
Right. And like when you call for prayer, when a whole nation together, so to speak, is all praying and they're all praying for the same thing, I do think there's an energy about that where there's a togetherness and there's an understanding that you and I are doing something to focus on helping, on charity, on loving. And so I'm putting myself in a really good place with that. And you're putting yourself in a good place with that. And we're both doing that. And I think that there's a togetherness about that that is really powerful and beautiful, but not the, okay, enough people prayed that finally Heavenly Father's listening. Not that.
All right, last two questions. Mm-hmm. Did Heather die a believer?
Yeah. I assume. I mean, I can't know what happened in her last days. I do know that she knew she was going to die. Like that. She started saying stuff and asking for stuff, indicating I'm not going to make it. So maybe that means she wasn't a believer. And maybe that does mean that. Although I don't think she was quite conscious enough, often enough to necessarily put that together in her mind. How do you know what's really happening consciously with somebody in that position? But I also know from our experience together that on the journey we took, as far as we took it, we were together. And so I feel very comfortable in surmising, no matter where she was when she died, which I assume is as believing as I was, she would be with me where I'm at now.
So this is a compound final question, but do you believe she's still somewhere and that you'll be with her again?
Oh, I hope so. I have really made peace with the idea that she's not, because I don't know. That started to break down a lot of church things for me as well, right away, because the church answers are that because she is sealed and she has the gospel, she went to the spirit world, where she was in spirit paradise, and proceeded to be a missionary to those in spirit prison so that she could teach the gospel and they could learn it and do temple work. And maybe she's in the temple doing temple work, helping people through there so that they can get their salvation and come back to the spirit paradise where they will eventually get resurrected. And this whole plan of salvation, she's busy doing all this work. It's a really good thing. Except she really did not want to go on a mission, because she didn't like talking to people. She didn't like this whole proselyting thing. So not her. There's no way that she went right over and started doing missionary work in the spirit paradise, unless she became a different person altogether when she died, in which case, what's the point of this life if you suddenly become somebody different? So who she is did not match with what I knew about what she was supposed to be doing over there. So yeah, that doesn't really work. Then there's she's with you. She's always with you. She's around your children. She's in your house. Look, I love that idea. I'm not going to lie. But it's not enough. It's almost insulting as an idea, because it's so not enough. And it occurred to me rather quickly, if she is here, if her spirit exists with me, then she is spending all of her time watching me sobbing on the floor, and her children falling down the stairs or doing their homework or whatever, and she can't help them. She can't stop their pain. She can't do anything. She can't even say hi to me. That's hell. That's hell. That she has to sit here and watch her children and can say and do nothing. That's not guardian angel. That's not beautiful. It's hell. I cannot wish that for her. I like to imagine that time is so different that she died, and by the time she literally turns around, so am I. And so she doesn't even know she's gone until I'm already there with her. I like to wish that for her. I like to wish a lot of things that feel nice, but it's all wishing that I maintain. It's all wishing what we hope it is. If I die and there's nothing there, I'll never know, and I'm okay with that because I'll never know. I can't. I hope I see her again. I so hope that her children get to meet her. But I'm not banking my life on it. I do believe, I do absolutely believe, by choice, that if she is someone, and it's possible to see her again, that I will. There is nothing, no temple ordinance or lack thereof, or behavior or obedience or law or ordinance of any kind anywhere that will keep me from her if she exists and we all go to somewhere where we can see each other. I will see her and I will be with her, and it has nothing to do with the church. And I hope that's